Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world today, this is QSO. Richard Moseson, editor of CQ Magazine, our guest. And you mentioned bring you back to young people in ham radio. So the floor is yours. Go ahead.
Okay. One of the things that I hear in so many places from so many people today is, oh, we don't bring in young people like we used to. And I've thought a lot about that. And I'm not real sure how many we used to bring in. There's this impression that 30, 40 years ago, there was just this onslaught of young people coming into ham radio. And I don't know how it was in the 50s and early 60s, but when I came into ham radio in the late 60s and early 70s, there wasn't an onslaught. There were, I was in a high school with probably about 1,500 kids, and there were 10 of us in the ham radio club, and about five or six had licenses. And we were the geeks. And, you know, we were together because we couldn't find anybody else to hang out with. but we certainly, there was no great, huge number of kids in my high school who were interested in ham radio. There were a dozen of us. And only about a half dozen with the patience and discipline to actually get their licenses. And there was one local club in our area that welcomed our participation, but we were the only kids who came to any of their events. And there was another club around that, you know, made it clear that they weren't interested in having kids around. So I think a lot of the people who are saying this today remember their own experiences, because I think a lot of people who are active today and have been for 30 or 40 years started out in ham radio as kids. But they weren't in the majority then. They're not in the majority now. I still see a good number of 20-something people at hamfests. I've been seeing an equal number of, you know, of baby carriages to mobility carts at some of the major hamfests. And I've seen a lot of little kids with handhelds on their belts. So I think that our perception of the number of young people that we're drawing in today is perhaps skewed in two directions. One, we think there were a lot more 30, 40 years ago, and we think there are a lot less today than there really are. What is really impressing me, though, is not so much the quantity, but the quality of the young hams that we're seeing today. I have the privilege of serving on the judging committee for the Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award. CQ is one of the corporate sponsors of that award. And I read these nominations. This year we got 30 nominations for young hams to be considered for this award. And the majority of them were well qualified. And we obviously had to pick one, and she's a delightful young lady, Emily Stewart, KC0PTL from Kansas. But the things that these kids are doing, the activities that they're involved in, the leadership that they're showing, I am so impressed with them. You know, I am saying, yeah, I think I talked about it in one editorial or another. I lose track at some point here. We're seeing the next generation of leaders developing now in our teenagers and our 20-something hams. You have a story on your website about a couple of new hams who saved a ham fest. And they are typical of the new generation of younger hams who are going to be the leaders of the hobby in the years to come. I look at somebody like the Young Ham of the Year from 2004, Andrea Hartledge, KG4IUM, who was back then a sophomore or junior in high school. Got to know her and her family after the award ceremony, and she is just an amazing person. She's put together the youth lounge at the ARRL booth at the Dayton Hamvention for the last couple of years, and a youth dinner. And she's now a student at Georgia Tech, and she was involved in a program that they have, kind of a Mars habitat thing, where they simulate what conditions would be like on Mars. First freshman to be involved in the program. And she got her whole group ham licenses, because the other groups that had been out there were using family radio service radios for communicating when they were outside of their dome or whatever it is, and they weren't having much luck with it. And she got everybody ham licenses, and they all communicated great. And she's an aerospace engineering major and wants to be an astronaut, and I'm sure she's going to succeed in that. And people like Andrea and like Emily and several other young hams that I've gotten to know either through the Young Ham of the Year program or submitting articles to CQ, there are great kids out there, and they are interested in this hobby and involved in this hobby. And we just have to be sure to give them space and let them in and give them encouragement, because there's still a lot of people out there who are resistant to young people. For all that some people are saying we don't get enough, there are those who say that they don't want anything to do with kids. So you got to be encouraging, and you got to give them space to learn, to excel, and to lead. And I'm very confident about the future of the hobby. I think it's going to be in very good hands.
Well, you know, I guess I've had a chance to view some of this firsthand, and there are those that, and I don't know what causes it, seem to meet the younger group with some contempt. And I guess I was fortunate enough, when I was growing up, I didn't really run into that. That was something that, if anything, from my generation, there were Elmers all over the place. And these guys were very, very much, you know, they were just elated to help a young person get into the hobby and show their station and work with them and all that sort of thing. And I hear a lot of talk about that, but then by the same token, I have witnessed it firsthand. And I can say it's a bit troublesome, and I don't know what the cause is. But I have seen that, and I don't know. Do you have any idea what drives any of that? Is there some cause of it that you're aware of?
Oh, grumpy old men, I think. Yeah. And I've seen it for years. You know, many of the young people who are coming into prominence as future leaders right now have been appointed in their ARRL sections as assistant section managers for youth. And in a previous life, back in the late 80s and early 90s, I was the ARRL section manager in northern New Jersey. And I appointed the first assistant section manager for youth in the country. And I'm ashamed to say I don't remember the person's name. But I do remember that at my encouragement, this person started going to club meetings to talk about about youth programming. And basically, after being told twice to sit down and shut up, he gave up on it and said, there's no point in doing this anymore. So there is some resistance out there, and it's nothing new. That was 20 years ago when I was first getting into the hobby. You know, it's the famous line of some guy on AHF, very selective about who he wanted to talk to.
I know what's coming.
No kids, no lids, no kids, no space cadets. And that kind of attitude isn't very encouraging, is it? And of course, you know, 40 years ago, space cadets was a whole different meaning than it is today, because we didn't really have people going into space and learning early about it. Today, a space cadet is very likely to be the next generation of space traveler. But that attitude has always been here, and you just have to try to avoid those people and try to find other people who are going to be more encouraging and stick with them.
Well, you know, again, any kind of organization, I don't care what it is, that exists. You know, I don't care if it's a trade association, a society of something. It doesn't matter what it is. And I see it a little bit in our Society of Broadcast Engineers group. It's the same kind of thing. I think it's human nature is what it is. And the only thing I can say is we just basically have to tell young folks, ignore them. You know, press on, move on, you know, and don't become discouraged by it, because it doesn't really amount to anything. And of course, I think a lot of, you know, younger people have more tenacity than some of us guys do. You know,
well, one interesting response that I've heard about, our website administrator lives in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and he's been very active in getting young people involved in ham radio. And apparently, on a lot of the repeaters and things there, they're not a very welcoming group. A lot of the kids have not felt welcome on the repeaters. They've turned to CW, to Morse code, and get on 80 meters and talk with Morse, and have become excellent CW operators as a result. Because, of course, one of the benefits to CW is that nobody knows how old you are, nobody knows your gender, nobody knows your color, nobody knows your nationality, and except for what's attached to a call sign. Ham radio in general is a very egalitarian hobby. CW all the more so, because all you find out about a person, or all you can judge about a person, is the quality of their sending. And you can't make any other judgments based on the sound of their voice or anything else. So it becomes even more of an equal playing field. So a lot of these kids in the Minnesota area have become avid CW operators because they were not welcomed on the repeaters. So, again, that's part of the tenacity. They weren't about to give up, but they were just shifted gears and said, okay, we'll do it differently.
That is really encouraging and really quite amazing. Richard Moseson, editor of CQ Magazine, is our guest.
Around the world.
something special for you. TW Antennas, your DX adventure has got a special going on right now. You can now save on shipping when you buy the complete TW 2010 Traveler Antenna Combo. Now, the complete package includes the TW 2010 antenna, the quadruped, and the deluxe transport bag. You have to see this. Go to the website and check this out. It's a complete package plus $50 savings on shipping. The complete package is $549.85. That's $549.85. But check it out on the website. Go and look at twantennas.com. And if you can't find that, go to our website. And that's tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, for the QSO radio program. And check out the TW Antenna Special right now on QSO. Richard Moseson, editor of CQ Magazine. And we were talking about young people in CW. One of the things that's amazed me, and sitting in the editor's chair at CQ, one of the things I've heard this from Gordon West about his code tapes. I've heard it from the folks at Vibroplex. They're saying that the lifting of the no code restriction on the license has almost increased the interest in CW. Have you got a feel for that at all? Have you picked up on any of this?
And I agree. There is more interest and more activity. It's all psychological. What was once perceived as an obstacle is now a challenge. And you approach a challenge very differently than you approach an obstacle. And it's fascinating. But I have seen upticks in activity. I've talked to the folks at Vibroplex also. I mean, their bread and butter is selling code keys. And, you know, one of the things that always bothered me in the debate over the code requirement is the assumption that was made by so many people that unless knowledge of Morse code was a requirement, that nobody would learn it. And this is from code enthusiasts. And I've always gone to them, wait a minute, why do you operate code? Because you have to? They go, no, because I love it, because I enjoy it. I can work more DX, because there are some DX stations that only have 10 watts and a spaghetti string for an antenna, and they can only get a signal out on CW. Or, you know, I like to go out in the woods and carry the simplest radio possible, and that would be a CW transmitter. Or, you know, when it all falls apart in a disaster and nothing is getting through, CW will still get through. All of these wonderful reasons why it's good to know and use Morse code, none of those went away. I've always been of the opinion that as a mode, Morse code has enough going for it that it can stand on its own without having to be a license requirement. And I think that's what we've seen in the last year and a half since the code test was eliminated. It is being appreciated by people for its own sake and its own benefits, not because they have to. My son has a friend who is a film major in college right now, who, as an assignment to do a mini documentary, decided to do one on ham radio. I'm not sure if he's ever finished the assignment, but he got so fascinated by ham radio that he went out and got a license. And last I heard, he was teaching himself Morse code. Now, he doesn't have to. There's no code test anymore. So why does he want to do it? Because it's a challenge. Because he sees a value in it. And I think that he's typical of a lot of newer, younger hams today. They see value in it. It's worthwhile to them. And I'll tell you, in our contests, the number of entries in our CW contest continues to climb. Our September issue, we're going to have our CQ Worldwide CW contest results from last year. We have every year, it seems, a new record number of entries. So the interest in CW, gauged by activity in our CW contests, is growing and growing and growing. And based on what you hear on the bands, there are a lot of people out there not sending 30, 40 words a minute, but maybe 5 or 10 words a minute. And because they want to, not because they have to. And that's a big, big difference.
Well, you know, for the hobbyist, I've heard people say, well, you know, folks don't build projects anymore and they don't do all these different things. But building a CW transmitter, someone sitting down, which is a real, you know, it's a pretty basic project, but very doable today, unlike some of the other things that you may trying to build from scratch. But building a CW transmitter from scratch is a very doable thing.
Yes, it is. I mean, I've never considered myself a really technically competent person, and building things has never been one of my strong points. But even I have built a CW transmitter. I've got one of those little tuna tin transmitters. And I have a companion receiver sitting sealed in the tuna tin waiting to be built. But I had a ball building that thing. And, you know, when you finish it up and you plug in the battery and you plug in the key and it works, I'll tell you, there is no feeling comparable with that. You've put it together with your own hands and you turn it on and it works. And it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
Well, you know, I remember, you probably remember too, and I notice now that on eBay, these things are just out of sight. And that's the old Amico CW transmitter kits.
Mm-hmm.
What did they used to cost? $19 or something? It was a very low price. You know, people would buy these things, and the chassis was already punched out, and you had the mm-hmm. tube sockets and all that sort of thing. And I had a lot of fun building those. It was amazing because I had people ask me to build those for them. Now, why, I don't know. That's just the way it was. But even those things, even if you know, the nostalgia of building an older tube-type CW transmitter is also something very attainable, which is something that's somewhat foreign today in as far as technology is concerned. But it gives, you know, young people a chance to just, you know, have a lot of fun doing it.
It's another example of the hands-on opportunities that ham radio provides that is not available elsewhere. One of the most popular features that we have in CQ, one of our columnists, Dave Ingram, K4TWJ, in his World of Ideas column, a couple times a year, or maybe more than a couple, thinking about it, he'll have different projects for, you know, updated versions of these single tube rigs, or even not updated versions of classic tube rigs that you could build. These are some of the most popular things that we have. People love them, and it's not just the old timers. It's again the opportunity to get your hands in there and build something and make it work. As far as you know, well, nobody builds anything anymore. That's been a process that's been going on to a certain extent for decades. People in general have built what they've had to build. When ham radio started back in the 19-teens, there were no commercial radios. You had to build from scratch. Then in the 20s and 30s, commercial receivers came along. And people stopped building receivers to the same extent that they were, and they bought receivers, and they built transmitters because there weren't many commercial transmitters out there. After World War II, the transmitters started to come out as well, and the move shifted to kits. But still, receivers were complicated, and it was better to let the pros take care of it for you. And then transceivers came out, and they're pretty tough to build in the 70s. And everything since the invention of the integrated circuit has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And today, if you want features that your typical commercial rig has, well, you have to use surface mount technology. And most of us don't have the dexterity or the proper tools for doing surface mount work. So you look for other things if you're interested in that. And it's the QRP, or low power groups, have been very big in coming up with kits, and they've been very popular. One of those low power kit people morphed into one of the major manufacturers today, Elecraft, which sells kits. But they've now, with their latest model, the K3, it has too many features and too much surface mount stuff to really be sold as a kit. So it is a kind of a new concept in kit building, where all the boards are done and you basically are assembling them. It's kind of like in the 1980s and 90s, when computers were still a hobby. People would like to go out and build their own computers. They would buy all the different boards and put it all together, and you've built your own computer, even though you didn't solder any parts onto anything. But you still got the satisfaction of building your own. And that's where this is going with the higher-end kits, in order to provide the features that are wanted. But there's still a lot of opportunities out there to just build little things. And, of course, antennas continue to provide endless opportunities for experimentation and building. And software. That's where the next generation of experimenting and building is going into software. Another one of the new radios, the Flex Radio, which is a software-defined radio, they have a very active user group, which, with a fascinating aspect to it, the source code for the software is open source. And they've got people out there who are not only suggesting improvements and changes, they're writing them. And they're sending them in to the people, to the company. And a lot of those things are being integrated into the software for the radio in each new release. And they've been written by users. That's something new and different.
Software-defined open-source radio. That's amazing. I haven't heard about this. This is, I guess, like I said, sitting in your chair, you get exposed to these things, you know, and probably a lot more exposure than the average guy does. I guess that's one of the reasons why we all need to read CQ. Richard Moseson, the editor of CQ Magazine, is our guest.
Wireless. You hear that word used a lot today. We have wireless telephones, wireless internet systems, wireless microphones. What it actually means is that they are radios. And who knows more about radios than amateur radio operators? Call them amateurs or call them hams. They know the modern wireless world. They helped create it.
And now here's Dave Sparks, N4OZO, for the TW Antenna Company.
Good to be on the show here, Ted. One of the things that I noticed right off is it's an antenna that can be set up extremely quickly. It can be set up in less than 5 minutes, which just makes it great for taking on portable de-expeditions or even for campers that need a portable antenna to set up, emergency situations, field day. There's just endless uses for an antenna that can be set up as quickly as the 2010.
When you put the antenna, when you first saw the antenna, be honest, what did you think the first time you saw it?
I'll be honest with you, I was a little bit hesitant when I first saw the antenna. Of course, at that time, I hadn't tried one. And I think a lot of times, all of us hams are a little bit sort of hold-offish until we actually get a chance to try something. We tend to not suspect or very much out of a product like that. The antenna for its size, which it's not real tall, it's only about 6 foot 10 inches tall, the actual antenna, you just look at something like that and you don't really expect a lot. And that's where I was wrong.
So when you hooked it up and you started using it, what was the first thing that surprised you?
The first thing that surprised me is if I could hear them, I could work them. And it didn't matter where in the world they were. And that just, it brought an immediate smile to my face.
So where are some of the places that you have talked to? Some of the places you've worked with this antenna?
I have worked, besides just numerous stations around the country, I've worked a lot of stations over in Europe, Asia, Africa. And one of my favorite things to do, Ted, is I like to work islands. And so I have really concentrated on working a lot of islands with it, and I've really done well. I recently worked the Ducie Island de-expedition on both 20 and 17 meters and got them like on each band in the first or second or third try. And I was just really surprised.
How does the thing do stateside? You know, we know it's a good DX antenna. I've heard this really low takeoff, 26-degree takeoff angle that it has.
Right, right.
But how does it do stateside? Is it going to do some rag chewing on
17? Well, it does really well. The people that I've talked to, even around the States, Ted, when I tell them what type of antenna that I'm using, and oftentimes you get asked this, especially if you're putting in a pretty good signal to the other party that you're talking to, and I describe the antenna to them, and you can tell at first they're puzzled, and then they'll go to the website and look the antenna up. Sometimes when I'm on the air with them, they'll do that. And, of course, they're surprised. And what really surprises them is not only are they looking at it and seeing what it is on the website, but they're hearing me talk on it at the same time. So they get a chance to really see what the performance of the antenna is while they're looking at it.
Thank you much for joining me here. And we're going to hear from you every week now, and you're going to tell us all about your activities on the TW2010 and then the up-and-coming TW8020.
Yes, that is in the design works right now.
You're listening to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And our guest this week is Richard Mosesson. He's the editor of CQ Magazine. We'll have more coming up right here on QSO.
Right about now, the Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, the Funk Soul Brother. Right about now. Funk Soul Brother, check it out now. The Funk Soul Brother, right about now. The Funk Soul Brother, check it out now. The Funk Soul Brother, right about now. The Funk Soul Brother, right about now. About now. About now. About now.
Richard Mosesson, CQ Magazine. He's the editor, and we've had a very, very interesting visit so far. Richard, tell me about the direction of the magazine, some things you'd like to share with folks as to what CQ is up to, what to be looking for, and just all the interesting things. I know you've got things you want to say, so just the floor is yours. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that we want to do is share with our readers some of the new developments that we've been talking about on the program here, the directions that the technology is going, and also try to hear from some of our younger hams. We've got a couple of young hams who have been writing articles for us. We've decided as of this year to expand our involvement in the Young Ham of the Year Award program, and we're inviting each year's winner to write an article for us on the activity for which they, or activities for which they were nominated, and looking forward to seeing that come to fruition. We've got a couple of other young people who have been writing things, and basically, our goal is to keep up with the latest developments and keep our readers up on them, as well as providing a lot of hands-on practical tips on operating different modes and different activities and how to get the most out of this wonderful hobby of ours.
If a person wants to subscribe, maybe they've let their subscription slide, and we do that frequently. I'll tell you, I'm finding CQ at Books A Million. I'm finding it at Borders and almost any major bookstore. But for convenience, how can folks just sign up and subscribe? They don't have to worry about running down to the local bookstore to get the latest issue.
Well, it's not only convenient, but you'd save a lot of money by subscribing over the newsstand price. There are three ways to subscribe. We make it pretty easy. You can go to our website, which is www.cq-amateur-radio.com, and click on the button that says Subscribe to CQ, and you can subscribe online. You can call our toll-free subscription line at 800-853-9797 during East Coast business hours. Each issue of the magazine has a subscription card in it, postage paid, and so if you do pick one up at the bookstore and you decide you'd like to subscribe, there's a little self-mailer in there that you can just tear out and send in. And
it's a wonder. It's also for you grumpy old men. This is a great gift for a young person that's an aspiring ham, someone getting into ham radio. And it's obviously not a high priced item. This is something very, very good to do, would be to subscribe for a younger person that has an interest in ham radio. Also, PopCom, Popular Communications, is published by your company, which is, you have a number of publications. Why don't you tell us a little bit about all those?
Okay, we have three magazines at the moment. Besides CQ, there's Popular Communications, which is about the whole broad world of the radio hobby. including shortwave listening and scanning and utility listening and you name it. If it has to do with radio waves going through the air, we cover it in some way, shape, or form in PopCom. And that's another monthly magazine. We also have CQVHF, which is a quarterly, and that's focused on ham radio above 50 megahertz, the VHF and UHF bands, and all the different things you can do on those bands. There's a huge world beyond FM and repeaters. We cover FM and repeaters, but we also provide introductions and some in-depth articles on a variety, whole variety of other things you can do on VHF and UHF, and on the propagation possibilities, and all sorts of stuff there. We also have books and videos that are available. We have ham radio calendars every year. In fact, I'm just working on the 2009-2010 one right now. Mind-boggling to think that 2010 is around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
But indeed it is. And
well, as we're getting closer and closer to the end of the Mayan calendar, they keep talking about 2012, all these strange things are going to happen. So
Y2K revisited.
Yeah, there you go. Tell us just briefly a little bit about, you've got an editorial coming up in the September issue. Tell me a little bit about, just give us a little taste of what to look at there.
My September editorial is somewhat of a response to something that appeared on America Online a couple of weeks ago. There was a feature that they had called Top 25 Things Vanishing from America. And one of the things listed right about the middle someplace was ham radio. And obviously, I disagree rather strenuously with that perception. And I spend a fair amount of the editorial talking about licensing numbers and what they mean, as opposed to just the numbers themselves and significance behind certain things. And some of what we've been talking about is negative perceptions of amateur radio that are indeed sometimes promoted by amateurs themselves. And
sometimes unknowingly.
Often incorrectly. I'm sorry?
I said sometimes unknowingly. I mean, they don't realize what they're saying. They don't understand what the actual numbers are or what the reality of the situation is. They just go by something someone else said or something they've seen.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's a newspaper article about a high school radio club that was basically an excellent article, but the advisor to the club, who's a ham, says there's no secret that ham radio is an older man's hobby. If we can get young kids interested, maybe we'll save the hobby from extinction. Well, that certainly suggests that the hobby is on the verge of extinction, which it isn't. We are near our all-time high in terms of licensees. A little bit off from it, but that was another part of the editorial, is explaining why we are and where those numbers are coming from. We're continuing to get 25,000 to 30,000 new people every year. So you look at that over the course of 4 or 5 years, and you've got between 100,000 and 150,000 new people coming into the hobby. And you've got, if you look at some of the other numbers, for example, there's a great website for keeping track of ham numbers that's run by Joe Speroni, AH0A, and it's OH0A.org. And he does all sorts of analysis with licensing numbers. And one of the things that he looks at is the number of months remaining on the average license, and 60 months being the midpoint, 5 years on a 10-year license. And during the past, when he started counting that in like 1999, I think he started it, they were negative, below 60 months. since about 2004, they have been moving upward for all license classes except novice, which is going to go away because there are no new ones being issued, and people are either going to upgrade or renew or not be active. But for all of the license classes, the trend is positive. The overall average right now is 68 months, which means that the average ham has either had a license issued or renewed their license within the past 5 years. And that shows really significant good things in terms of activity levels. That even if people are not active on the air at the moment, they consider their ham license to be important enough that they make sure to renew it. Because one of the great things about ham radio is that you can always come back to it. And that's one of the great unseen growth areas, because it doesn't show up in the licensing numbers. But I have seen dozens and dozens of people at HamFest who have said, well, I'm just getting back in the hobby now after 20 years. You know, I've kept up my license, but I haven't been on the air in 20 or 30 years, and I'm just getting back into it. And, you know, where do I go? What do I do? And every HamFest, there are two or three of these people that I see. And that's a snapshot. But if there's that many that I'm seeing, there's that many more out there who I'm not seeing and not hearing from. And you can't track that kind of growth in the numbers, because they have licenses, they've had licenses, but they're now, they've been inactive and they're getting back on the air. They're rediscovering what ham radio can do for them and what they can do for ham radio. And so that's a silent growth area, but it's a very important one.
Well, you know, I know that a lot of folks, when you go to a ham fest, and I'll go ahead and get into this a little bit, you look around, and a lot of the ham fests appear to be shrinking. In other words, you go to the ham fest, and there doesn't seem to be as many people there. And I was going to ask the question to you, because you, once again, you sit in a bird's eye view. How much impact do you think eBay has had on ham fests?
I think eBay has had a significant amount of impact on ham fests, but I think it's starting to fade, because people are finding that it's not always, you don't always get what you think you're getting, because you don't have an opportunity to actually see it up close, and a lot of the prices got inflated, and you know, you're finding that what you paid isn't—it's not really worth what you paid for it, because you got into this bidding war with somebody. But it has affected what comes to flea markets, and flea markets are a significant, important part of hamfests. Curiously, though, while there are many hamfests that have been having attendance dropping off, there are others that are growing. And growing consistently. So it's not a trend that is universal. You have shows like Orlando, Dallas, Nearfest in New England. These are all growing shows. So there's a lot to be said about how well run a show is, and how they deal with their vendors, how they deal with publicity, how they deal with people coming in. There are a lot of factors that go into the success or lack thereof of a hamfest. So I don't think you can pin changes in numbers on any one thing. Of course, gas prices right now are having an impact too. On the other hand, one of the bigger hamfests in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago was packed with people. There were worries that people wouldn't show up because of gas, but it was packed. So there's a lot of factors that go into how well a hamfest does. Well, I don't think you can pin it on any one.
I had heard at Dayton, someone who had said that the crowd at Dayton was down somewhat. However, the folks that were there were really buying, because the vendors I talked to said they did exceptionally well this year at Dayton. So, you know, I'm wondering if the gas prices are not going to promote activity on the ham bands, because a lot of folks are just going to say, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying home. And there's the radio.
Yeah, that's definitely a trend. It's an interesting thing. Ham radio tends to be counter-cyclical with the overall economy. This is something that we've seen over decades, that when the economy is struggling, ham radio does pretty well. And I think it's for exactly that reason, that I don't have the money to spend on a fancy vacation this year. I'm not going to be able to go on that cruise, so I'll buy a new radio for a quarter of the price of the cruise and talk to people around the world instead of visiting them.
Well, I think even on short-term trips, I mean, I catch myself, and I think everyone does, saying, wait a minute, I was going to run over across town and do so-and-so. I think I'm going to skip that today. You know, I don't want to put another $30 in the gas tank to cross town. I think I'm going to stay home. And, of course, there's that radio staring you in the face, you know. So it's saying, hey, come on over here and sit down. This doesn't cost very much to do. You know, and I really think that may be, if there's anything gained from our high gas prices, is going to be the fact that a lot of folks are going to be focusing on home. And, of course, that means if you have a ham license, you may be focused more on the radio. And other things, maybe even like CQ Magazine. So,
I certainly hope so.
Our guest has been Richard Moseson. He's the editor of CQ Magazine. This has been a most fascinating conversation. It's been really, really good. I've enjoyed this. And, Richard, I would really love for you to come back and join us again and bring us up to date on things and talk about all this going on, because I've enjoyed this, and I know folks listening have enjoyed it as well.
Well, I've had a good time, too, so it'll be fun to do it again sometime.
Thank you very much. That's going to do it for this edition of QSO. Our guest this week has been Richard Moseson, the editor of CQ Magazine. We invite you to come back again next week, same time, same station, right here for QSO, brought to you by TW Antenna Company, Heil Sound, and Gigaparts.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, day proved through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave?